Radhika Gupta is a 37-year-old trailblazer of the Indian corporate world. She's the CEO of Edelweiss Asset Management. But more importantly, she is possibly one of the most inspirational women I've met in my life. Trust me, whether you're an entrepreneur or an aspiring corporate, you've got to listen to this episode till the end. She's also one of the most eloquent speakers I've met in my life. I am going to have her many, many more times on the Ranveer Show. But this is her basic story. How she went from being born in Pakistan to living all over the world in countries including Nigeria, including USA, picked up traits from all those countries, applied it to her entrepreneurship career, and applied it to her already legendary corporate career. She's also become one of India's top Twitter influencers. And if you don't follow her on Twitter, man, you are missing out. Trust me when I say this. 50 years from now, when we're looking back at the story of a developing India, there's going to be a big chapter written on Radhika Gupta. That's the kind of mindset she has. That's the kind of impact that she's already created at the age of 37 in the corporate world. You guys have to listen to this woman to understand this kind of a powerful mindset and believe that these kind of mindsets exist in the modern day. If you just want to watch highlights of this episode, make sure you log on to the Ranveer Show clips on YouTube. And also keep in mind, we've already started releasing our Hindi podcasts that are equally as powerful. It's called the Ranveer Show Hindi. Search for it on your audio platforms. But for now, I'm going to leave you with one of India's most powerful minds, Radhika Gupta, featured on the Ranveer Show. Radhika Gupta, ma'am, thank you for being on the Ranveer Show.
Thank you for having me.
So for our listeners, Radhika Gupta is one of the trailblazers of the corporate world. One of the most fascinating stories I've come across. So before every podcast, I do an intense read up on our guests. And I just kept reading about your story. Like everything. You've grown up all over the world.
Yep.
You eventually found yourself in the Indian corporate scene. You're one of the country's youngest CEOs, and you're kind of what I would like to call, you know, this is not written, but this is my gauge of it. You're one of the country's most feared CEOs.
I'm feared?
in a very positive way.
Yeah, feared or fearless now? You have to...
Fearless and
feared. Yeah. Feared is a nice one. Interesting.
Yeah, so today you're the CEO of Edelweiss Mutual Funds.
Yes.
Interesting story, but Edelweiss was one of the companies that I was targeting in terms of my first job when I was in engineering
college. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. How did you find out about Edelweiss?
So, you know, while you're in engineering college, you're constantly told that, you know, there's other things you can do outside of engineering.
Ah.
And you just assume that, okay, the other things are finance or startups.
Huh.
So I thought, no, I might be too young for startups. So why not try finance? And Edelweiss seemed like a cool company from the outside. But I have so many questions about the world of finance in general. I have so many questions about the corporate world because that's something I've never delved into. And honestly, you know, like when you're a younger entrepreneur and you're brash and you've also had an entrepreneurial...
And I've gone through that phase of the obnoxious young entrepreneur.
Exactly. You're obnoxious.
Yes, so obnoxious.
A part of you, you know, for lack of a better word, you kind of look down on the corporate world because they look down on you as well.
Yes.
So, like, I mean, I have so many questions about the corporate world in general, but let's start with your story. Where did this start? And very interesting, I know that you were born in Pakistan.
Yes, I was born in Pakistan, and it's really funny. So I was born in Pakistan, and I'm not that old, contrary to the attire. So I was born in 83 in Pakistan, which is kind of rare. And in fact, once in the office, I have to tell you this, I told some guy I'm born in Pakistan, and he looked at me with this strange kind of disbelief. And then he held my hand, and he's like, it must have been really sad coming on that train during the partition. It's like, okay, no, I was not. So my dad is a career diplomat. He was actually born in a village in UP called Gango, district, village kind of thing. And he ranked, I think, 10th or 7th All India, which is crazy in the civil services, first one. And then he got into the foreign service. And he had the choice at that point of going to Pakistan or Switzerland. And my mom keeps telling me this. She's like, you know, when we got married, I was like, I've married a foreign service officer. And there was this whole Yash Chopra and Silsila and all that phase going on. And I was like, let's go to Switzerland. And he's like, let's go to Pakistan. It's good for my career because it's a neighboring country. So we lived in Pakistan between 83 and 87.
Do you have any memories of junior KG in Pakistan?
No, I could not go to school because in Pakistan, it is too unsafe for an Indian diplomat's kids to go to school.
Wow.
In fact, it is so unsafe that you can't even see an external doctor. I mean, as you think about it, it makes sense. So what the government does is the embassy has their own doctors for you too. They have journalists, they have doctors, they have a whole ecosystem. It's one of our largest embassies in the world.
Do you have any memory of Pakistan?
I have memories of a very, very big house. My parents have lots of memories of Pakistan, and they have very, very positive memories of their Pakistan phase. They said the Indian embassy was a very bonded place because there was nothing else to do, right? Mm. I mean, there was nothing else to do, no one else to do. But I was really homeschooled. I was homeschooled for the first 4 years. And I keep joking with my friends these days who are obsessed with their kids getting into play school at 1 and 2 years. I was like, it is fine, you know, just homeschool them till 4 or 5. They'll turn out okay. Mm. So that was our memory of Pakistan. My mother has some very funny memories of guys spying on us and our phones being tapped. And she's like, we knew people who were sort of outside our house watching over us. And they knew that we knew. And we had a kind of nice, it's like they would even say, adab begum, you know, just used to go on. So that is how it was. And I was brought up, so my first language was actually Urdu.
Wow. And eventually you found yourself in Nigeria.
Eventually we found ourselves in Nigeria. So the government has a funny rule, which is that they rate countries in the world. So they take the world map and they rate it from A through C. So like A is cool countries like Italy or the US, and B is like average countries, I don't know what that is, and C is countries like Pakistan and Nigeria. And because they're super democratic, once you get posted to an A country, the next country will be a B or C country, and then it'll keep rotating. So like, we did Pakistan, then we were rewarded, so to say, with New York, which is a A-plus country.
Oh, wow.
After New York, then we were punished with Nigeria.
So
that's actually how the way, and it's really interesting because as a kid, you're actually going through very drastic changes because you're moving from a country like New York, where you have everything, which is so luxurious. And New York in the late 80s and 90s, I mean, this was a time when nothing, you used to get nothing in India, right? Mm. I remember coming back from New York and there were these orange packets of that Tang. I mean, you might be too, you too. But we used to carry this for everybody, right? Mm. I mean, nobody does that anymore. Mm. And then you move to a country like Nigeria where you can't get out of the house after 6 o'clock, where your house has a bulletproof door, where many of your friends and family have been robbed at gunpoint. There's nothing to do except sit at home. Mm. So the government, I mean, a foreign service kid's life actually is subject to a lot of extremes.
And this was in your teenage. So
this is in your teenage, yes.
Imagine what you went through. Like.
And this is pre-Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. So you can't even keep in touch with friends, right? Mm. I mean, who's going to send snail mail to Nigeria, right?
Who
do you keep in touch with, right? So the other thing with this life is that you don't have school friends.
Mm.
So like my husband grew up in Bombay. He has a ton of school friends. I don't have any school friends. I mean, I don't know anybody. So you also grow up with that. But Nigeria was a super interesting place to grow up. I mean, I've spoken about this. I really don't envy my mom because I think I was 12 and my brother was 9. And there was no place to go buy clothes in Nigeria. So if I wanted a swimsuit or like a prom dress, and I went to an American school where you have these prom dresses and all, she would have to go to this market called Yaba Market, this cloth market, where you actually buy clothes by the thaan and then put a tailor in the house and he would stitch every piece of clothing that you owned.
Wow.
So it's just a very interesting kind of childhood.
I'm going to bring you back to the present.
Yeah.
What did America add to the CEO's mind versus Nigeria adding to the CEO's mind?
So I think the change has added a lot. I think rather than, you know, there's something you pick up from each country. So one of the things I picked up from Nigeria, which is very true. So Nigeria is the most corrupt country in the world, right? I mean, you can't get petrol. You need 2 days of standing in line to get petrol. That's why people have two drivers in Nigeria. But if you look at the stats, Nigeria is actually one of the happiest countries in the world. Nigerians are constantly optimistic about life. And I think that's something that I picked up a lot. And a mentor of mine told me this. He said, leaders naturally have to be optimistic. You can't have a pessimist inspire a team or lead a team. So I think that was a really important learning that I got from my Nigeria days. And I think I've picked up something from each country I've lived in, whether it's Italy.
Why do you think Nigeria is so unsafe though? Because even I've heard stories about, like, I was with a relative once and he said that he feared going to Nigeria on assignments, and he's a techie, he's an engineer in America. And he said that a friend of his went there or landed up at the Lagos airport.
Yeah.
His driver picked him up, and instead of taking him to the hotel, they took him into a forest, and then they found out that that driver wasn't the real driver.
He made, totally believable.
Yeah, he made that guy strip down to his underwear, took his watch, took all his belongings, left him in the forest and drove away. And then the actual driver called him
and said, listen, I'm your driver.
Yeah.
I think it's had a very violent history. It's still got a lot of tribalism and communities, and it's a very poor country. There is, you know, one thing we're very lucky to have in India, and I'm speaking from the hat of someone in finance, is a big middle class. In Nigeria, there is extreme richness and extreme poverty. And that creates a sense of...
Why do they have what I have?
And so there's an interesting thing that when you go roam around in Nigeria, you always wear robbery jewelry, even a man. So he's got to wear a gold chain around his neck or a ring or something so that if someone robs you, you don't get killed. You can give your ring rather than your life.
I got mugged last year.
Oh, you were mugged last year?
Yeah, like in Bombay. I was walking in my area actually, which is actually a pretty relatively safe area of the city, Five Gardens.
Oh, that's super safe.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I've walked around all my life, and I was on the phone with someone walking. I was on the phone with Manish actually, our common friend. He was telling me something about business. He's also been on the podcast. I'm walking and I suddenly get whacked in the head. My specs fall off and my phone falls off as well. This guy, I was just confused because he whacked me hard. I was on the floor. I mean, I was on the footpath. And he takes the phone, runs away. Another guy comes on a bike, takes him away and goes away. So I couldn't even chase them. I couldn't take that guy.
In Five Gardens, which is like super safe.
Yeah. And so here's the creepier part of the story. He basically mugged me. I was in shock. I went and filed a police complaint, all that. And immediately after getting mugged, you have a sense of shock and you have a sense of why did that happen to me? And this was like last year when businesses are established and I'm... per se famous. And everything's going well and suddenly you get mugged. And then over the next 2 or 3 days, you realize, okay, wait, maybe that person just wanted that phone way more badly than I wanted it. So you kind of start asking questions about life, that why, like, I'm a good person. I've not done bad shit to anyone, but why has bad shit happened to me? And then you realize this class difference where you're like, you know, even in India, while it may not be as much as Nigeria, there is that class division of people who are given a lot versus people who are not.
So I went to school in Philadelphia in the US, and our area was actually a very unsafe area. So I saw a lot of mugging there. And if you come to this, I mean, you think about it, it actually had a community of very poor people and then all these university kids. And it's the same class difference. I mean, you wonder why people would mug a college kid, because a lot of kids in Philly at that point, I mean, there was a point which you knew you would not cross. Why would you mug a college kid, right? But it's the same thing, right? These people have come into our community and they have something that we don't have.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. So the creepier part of my story was later on, from an anonymous Instagram account, I got a message saying, hey, brother, I'm sorry, I was the guy who whacked you and took your phone. And that Instagram account was, it had like zero followers, zero whatever following. It was just like an account made for telling me this, that it was some fan who had like mugged me, and he said that this is your phone's IP, whatever the, you know, the identification number, and it was actually the correct identification number. And I didn't know what to do, and I was too busy by that point. I had forgotten about the mugging. I mean, I'd moved on, but it kind of just changed my whole perspective on fame, this concept of class difference. But yeah, there was, it was like an eye-opening thing, and that's where I actually got fascinated about West Africa. There's this other YouTuber who has a lot of business in West Africa. His name's Technical Guruji. He has explained to me how difficult it is just establishing
stuff. Yeah, and you talked about your friend who was scared to go there as an IT professional. I remember, I think my brother graduated from an Indian institute, and he said one of his friends got a college offer, and it was some $300,000 offer in Nigeria. And he asked me for advice. $200,000 of the offer was the worth of life insurance.
Wow. So does that country, other than giving you optimism, which again I find a little find a little strange from the outside, but I've never been to Nigeria, so I never know. What else does Nigeria give you?
It also tells you about the importance of a community, right? And I think we can be very individualistic. So if you look at Nigeria, and we all had help in Nigeria, you know, your help will run out of money by the 15th or 20th day of the month. And so you'll ask your help, you know, where is the money? And she's like, you know, I helped my sister in another village. So my mother asked her month after month. Wow. And at some point she's like, how many sisters do you have? Because she thought real sister. But in Nigeria, sister means anybody from your community, because they believe that when tough times come on them, the community comes to support them. I think that's a great learning at this time. I mean, I always tell people in financial services too, that build a sense of community around you. It's interesting, you know, you haven't asked me this, but as I've sort of grown up, I've realized that women are a rare community in most of the corporate world. And when I was in my 20s, I didn't care about feminism. I thought this whole gender debate was quite nonsense, because we are all 50-50 at that point. There are 50% guys, 50% girls. As I have become older, I've actually realized this importance of community, especially being a girl, and the importance of building a community of women and standing up for each other. So this whole concept of sisterhood that I learned in Nigeria, it's now kicking in a very different way.
Yeah. Here's a scary stat, which I actually might get slightly wrong, but Kunal Shah, the founder of Cred, was on the show recently, and he said that in urban metros, in Bombay, Delhi, Bangalore, something like 80 to 90% of the women are just like sitting at home.
It could be, because 25% of our women participate in the workforce. I mean, I'll get into trouble for this, but in my own industry, we have 45 mutual fund companies in India. I mean, let's just do some quick math. There are about 4 or 5 leadership roles, CEO, head of investments, et cetera, et cetera. So 45 times 5 means there should be 200, otherwise 150 senior positions. I counted and I think 5 are filled by women.
That's crazy.
And it's not, by the way, that we don't know how to manage money.
Yeah, no, it's not that at all. So, you know, as a guy, you kind of take this for granted, because it's not really your concern. You don't notice all these things till you grow up. Maybe if you become an entrepreneur and you have women and men working, that's when you start noticing these little
things,
cracks in society, which is actually the first kind of reason I thought I should have you on the show. I read one of your tweets, which I just told you about before the podcast.
Yeah, I remember this.
You'd posted a video of basically Trump and Modi are together. They're walking down this pathway.
Yes.
And there's like 10 girls there wearing Bharatanatyam costumes and one guy wearing this traditional Indian outfit. And that one guy, it's a kid. And
he's a kid in a white outfit.
Yeah, the kid pulls out his phone and goes up to Modi and Trump and says, hey, can I get a photo?
Yeah.
And they oblige, they take the photo with them. And your caption on that was, I'm going to let you actually complete it.
So there's two parts to it. So my caption on that was, ask for opportunities, because nobody is going to do anything for you. And the other thing about that photo is, so while the kid's tapping and asking, look at the expression of the girls. So a lot of people trolled me on that, saying, well, what if the girls didn't want a photo? But my answer is, look at the expression of the girls. They were like, almost like that Miss India moment. Like, I can't believe he caught it. Well, my point is, why did he get it? He asked. And you know what? The girls were first in line, but they didn't ask. And so I go to all these women's sessions and they keep asking me, you know, what's your advice for young girls? And I'm like, just ask for opportunities. Ask for the big promotion. If you're competent at something, ask. I think, you know, on average, if a woman is 8 out of 10, she's probably going to rate herself 6 and a guy is going to rate herself 11.
Yes, that's an actual study. One of my friends who's a consultant at Bain, she sent me this exact, that's an actual study.
There you go.
What you quoted. They had actually asked a bunch of women this and exactly that happened. Most of the women rated themselves lower than the capabilities and most of the guys rated themselves higher than the capabilities. And it might be societal conditioning, genetical conditioning. I don't know what it is.
It's all that. So it's the smallest thing. So I remember when I was getting married, I had these pheras and I was wearing a reasonably light lehenga. So I was walking and I walk fast. So I was walking around the fire quickly and my husband was walking. And the pandit actually told me, and I might get into trouble for saying that, this is slow down. You should look shy.
Wow. And from a young age, you're told stuff like this.
I'm like, but why should I slow down? We are walking and I'm walking at the pace that is comfortable to me. So you're told not to ask. You're told to slow down. But I'm saying nobody is going to look in a room and say, oh, that girl is really great, you know. I should give this role to her. The girl has to ask now. She has to raise her hand up. That's how, by the way, I got the CEO role only because I asked for it.
That's crazy. And you know, again, as a once you're in a leadership position, what you understand about women in your workforce is that they add completely different dynamics to the same projects compared to men. Even men have their own, you know, good things that they add to the project, but the same goes for women. And the best organizations will always contain, according to me, an equal mix of men and women, but we're probably far from that.
And it's also, it's actually not just about gender. I mean, I learned this in my first job at McKinsey. It's a diversity of every kind adds value, right? You have someone who's a physicist versus someone who is a lawyer versus someone who is an engineer, they will all have different perspectives. I mean, I believe organizations should have diversity of age. You can't have 30, you know, 50-year-olds and no young population. So it's not just gender is one form of diversity. But diversity of everything matters, right?
Yeah. One whole section on this podcast is going to be about how you overcame this gender bias, age bias, all these things. But before you actually, you know, went on to the corporate path, you also had an entrepreneurial side of things. And before that, you were in Wharton.
Yes.
And right after Wharton, you had an extremely dark phase of your life.
Yes. One dark phase.
But so what after Nigeria, what had happened?
So after Nigeria, my father moved to Italy, which is where I did my high school. Awesome place, by the way, like the best place I've lived on earth. And then I think by the time I was in 10th or 11th, there was this thing that, you know, what do you want to do next? And so dad is in the government. Mom has been a teacher. So
what did that add to your personality?
Oh, Italy is such a lovely place. I think most of my habits, personal habits, are shaped by Italy, like my food, everything I want to do. But I think what I love about Italy, and I actually do a talk on what different countries add to my personality, Italy is very proud of who they are. I think Europeans are very proud of their roots. Like, I always say that Italians celebrate every stone that there is in their country because they have a very rich heritage. They celebrate. So, you know, Italy is a home of espresso and cappuccino, and being a coffee fan, you'll love this. But, you know, there's no Starbucks in Italy, right? Because the Italians are not going to let, or till then there wasn't, I think. And the Italians are not going to let some random American company walk in and walk all over their culture. They make pizza their way, they make stuff their way. So they know their core and they celebrate it. And I think sometimes we can lose touch with it. It teaches you to celebrate your Indianness. So you should be proud of speaking your Hindi and walking around in your sari and celebrating your Ramayana and celebrating your Mahabharata and celebrating your, you know, culture. I mean, I keep joking that at one point in time, I have a secret desire to be the tourism minister of India. And this comes from living in Italy because I just believe we have such a tremendous heritage of tourism in this country. I mean, India should be the best place on earth for a tourist. Yeah. And we do a terrible job monetizing it.
100%. It's going, you know, my hope is that in 20 years' time, if I am in politics in any way, that's one department I wish to clean up from an entrepreneurial perspective so that we can make money off of tourism.
So tourism is your soft power, it's your brand, and it's business. And the Italians celebrate literally everything. And so that's what that brought to the table.
You know how many questions you're opening up for me through telling me all these things. But okay, let's come back to your, you know, career story.
Yes.
Ma'am, so like, what was your intention behind going to Wharton?
So I guess, you know, I have to thank my mother because she was super aspirational for me. She's like, you should apply abroad. And we didn't have, so government doesn't pay you very much money. And a college education is expensive overseas. I mean, it's $40,000-$50,000 a year then, which is like unthinkable. For 4 years, that's like, I remember saying it's like a crore, Papa, at that point in time, which is a big amount of money in our world. And I said, let's only apply to the places where I'll get scholarship. And, you know, the big schools don't give scholarship. They give loans and financial aid. My mom was like, apply to the best in the world. And why don't you just try?
And it was worth it?
It was worth it because I actually got into Wharton. I got in with financial aid, which is... So the college counselor told me that if you apply to Wharton as a normal candidate, you have a 1 in 7 or 1 in 8 chance of getting in. He said, if you apply and ask for money, also to support your education, you have a 1 in 40 chance of getting in. And it's like their way of saying, okay, don't do this, bhai. And my mom's like, no, but we are going to apply. And we are going to apply with financial aid. And we did. And she made me apply to the best in the world. And she actually sat with me through the whole process. She had no idea. We didn't use, you know, fancy college things. And, you know, there was none of that. I mean, sitting in Italy, we didn't have very much of that. But we actually just did it on a lark. We wrote essays from the heart. And that was it. And I always used to tell her that, you know, mom, I'm not an athlete and I don't have anything. I can't play any music. She's like, just tell them who you are. You have such an amazing background. Yeah. You're a good student. Just go tell them your story. Honestly, what's the worst that can happen? You won't get in anywhere. You'll go to India.
Mm.
That's how I got into college. I mean, that's actually how I got into college.
Ma'am, so what does this Ivy League education add to your head? Because, you know, I mean, a lot of parents. So, okay, I'll give you my perspective. Yeah. Right? So my dad's Punjabi and my mom is half Maharashtrian, half Guju, but she's much more Maharashtrian than she's Gujarati. And Maharashtrians give a lot of importance to education. So since I was like 3 years old, it was my mom's heartfelt dream that I go through an Ivy League education of some sort. And it broke her heart when I chose to make videos for a living. So so she still has that thing, you know, like even if I tell her right now that, listen, I'm kind of considering applying to an Ivy League college.
She'll like jump.
She will be like, yes, finally.
Finally.
It's like her ultimate thing. And that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
So my version of having that happen to me is asking people like yourself.
Okay.
What have I missed out on in life?
So look, I don't think an Ivy League education is the be-all and end-all. It's not like, you know, you don't get an Ivy League education because people like overdo the craze about it these days. So ultimately, you know, what you do, I mean, you can be perfectly successful without it. I think it can change your life. And I don't think it can change your life because of the 4 years there only and sitting in classes. I mean, classes are good and you meet world-class professors. But I just think the community of people that you get exposed to is incredible. Firstly, you're studying with kids from all around the world. And that is, and look, I had a global background, but studying with kids from all around the world is very different from traveling to Europe on a holiday. I think it's just a very different perspective. Secondly, I think you're always taught to like aim really, really high. So you're taught that you have to be a learner, that you have to push your mind. And I think that spirit stays with you even when you're 30 and 40. And the most powerful thing it does is it gives you an alumni network. So I used to head our alumni club here. We have about 1,000 alumni from my college in India. And we're very connected to each other.
And they all must be, you know, holding the top jobs in the country.
Yeah, they're of course, very, very successful professionals. But they're also a very close-knit community. And in my case, it's really interesting. My husband's, I met my husband in college. And all our close friends also married friends from college. So we have this group of about 5-6 of us couples. And we meet every weekend. And we just look at, and now, you know, I mean, some of them are CEOs of listed company and people have done very well for themselves, but we're bonded by those 4 years.
Are the conversations very intellectual?
They're not. They can be, but they're not. Sometimes they can be very silly, actually, because ultimately you're a group of college kids who were bonded by an experience when you were 18, 19, 20, 21. Mm. So I just think that's what it does. I think for me, it changed my life. It gave me a lot of the confidence I had today. I went through my tough bouts through it, but it gave me a lot of the exposure and confidence I have today.
You know, I always try finding polite ways to ask questions, but I'm not going to make this question polite. And it's going to be a dark question.
Okay, ask.
I read articles about you where they spoke about a phase where you even considered, you know, something like suicide. Like, so what had like happened in that phase? After you've had so much perspective, what drove you to that thought process?
So I think rejection is something I didn't handle well. And
professional rejection.
Yeah, I mean, it was rejection from on-campus placements. And, you know, anybody in India or overseas who's gone through this process of what I call looking for a job on campus knows that that is the most stressful phase of your life. And like, if anyone is watching this or hearing this and looking for that, just calm down. I think that process brings out the worst in people. I mean, it makes you unnecessarily competitive and it's a dog-eat-dog world. And You know, honestly, till then, Ranveer, I had never faced rejection. Because all through my life, I was like a good kid, class topper. I mean, the only insecurity I grew up with was around my looks. Because of my neck issues
That's
and my
all
weight
of us.
Issue. Yeah, and I think it's a little worse as a girl. Because like, you're an ugly looking teenage girl in like 13 and 14. And teenagers will go out there and say, oh, you're ugly looking. And you know, my mom happens to be beautiful. So they're like, your mom's so beautiful. And she used to teach in the same school. How did you turn up this way? Like, people actually say this kind of stuff. So if you see all that coupled with rejection, I think that's what. So I got rejected from a bunch of consulting interviews at that point, actually 7 in a go. And when I got rejected, I rationalized this later. So when I got rejected from the 7th one and I decided to try and jump off the 19th floor of the building, it was not even a huge consulting firm. You know what irritated me? It was the fact that I got rejected, but friends of mine who I thought had less grades got the job. It's like that dialogue, you know, in Three Idiots, ki khud ki haar itni nahi buri lagti, lekin dost jeet jaye na. So then you feel even worse. So I think my inability, and I don't think our system prepares you for rejection, right? Yeah. You're always told, beta, work hard, keep doing your thing, study, settle ho jaoge. But what happens if you work hard and fail? Who prepares you for failure at any point in time? So that was my first bout of failure. And
on what? Because I mean, I'm sure you've sat through many hiring drives yourself.
Yeah.
What basis do you think they rejected you on?
I don't know. And I found it to be a perfect conversation, right? And it's not like I haven't been rejected after that. It's just that I handle it much better. But I always believe that rejection in some way is redirection to a better place.
And this could even be romantic rejection.
This could be romantic rejection. This could be college rejection. This could be rejection from, you know, I mean, you're going to book a hotel and you didn't get it and you ended up staying at another one. I mean, it could be rejection. I mean, any kind of rejection. For instance, when I was applying to college, I thought MIT was my dream school. Like, I wanted to be an engineer, nerdy, all that. I didn't get into MIT. In retrospect, I think they rejected me because I was not the right fit. Maybe this consulting firm rejected me because I was not the right fit, or someone else was a better fit than me. And I ended up at McKinsey, which was great for me. So I always think rejection could be just God's way of saying, you know, you're meant for something else that's a better fit for you.
Yeah, 100%. Rejection opens up new dimensions.
It does. And that's why I said redirection to a place that might be better for you. But you're not taught how to handle rejection well.
How old were you when you had climbed to that 19th floor and that was happening?
I think I was 20. 19 or 20.
Well, I mean, you've already seen Nigeria, USA, Italy. You had experiences there.
Yeah.
What was flashing through your head?
I was like, why is this? So, in my head, it was like, I'm a really good kid here. I really worked very hard. I went to Wharton on a scholarship, which was very rare. I've kind of survived all this. And how can I be rejected 7 times here? Like, one time is okay. But how can someone be rejected 7 times after being topper of her class, going through all of this, being super sincere about everything? I mean, that's what goes through your head, right? How can they reject me?
Why did you not jump?
Oh, I was lucky. My best friend at that time, who most people don't know is my husband today, he was sitting with me and he just called the cops. And he's like, this girl is trying to jump out of the window, do something. And that's when the cops came and they took me to this mental asylum, this thing that existed on campus. And then I had to escape. And my father was in a country called Zambia at that point in time. He had moved to Zambia from Italy. So I remember calling him at 3 in the morning saying, Papa, I need to get out of this asylum. And he said, how did you land up there in the first place? I said, you know, a boy, I was trying to do this. And a boy, I mean, he asked me the same question, that why did you not? I said, listen, I was with this guy and he called the cops. And he's like, who is this guy? He was more worried about, I think, the boyfriend than the jumping off the floor. Traditional Indian father. But that's how I got out of it.
Wow, that's a very intense story. But you got me. I'm sorry, I'm just a little blown away right now. So I've lost my flow. Did that add any layer to your personality? Just coming out of that?
After that, I was a lot more relaxed. I was like, so I had a job offer at Microsoft. And then I went into my last interview at McKinsey. Obviously,
in a good way, can I say that you stopped taking yourself as seriously?
Yeah, I was just like, I stopped taking life a little less seriously. I still take life seriously. But I calmed down a little bit. It's like, this is just not what I was like, okay, I can't be this dramatic about everything that happens in life. You know, I just have to cool it. My husband always says, you know, stop and smell the coffee. Stop and smell the roses. Just calm down. Like, what's the worst? I mean, he was like, what's the worst that could happen to you? You'll get rejected by 7 consulting companies. I had a confirmed job offer at Microsoft. He's like, that's not such a bad deal in life, right? So I just started seeing the other side of life and putting my problems into perspective. And I think that helped.
Yeah, and now you're building one of the biggest corporate careers that India's seen.
And, you know, I think telling the story obviously much later has helped me a lot. I mean, I'm glad I lived through that story because I also had the ability to tell it later.
Do you think you've been free of mental health issues since?
Pretty free, actually. Pretty free. It's not that I don't go through pretty crappy days. I mean, I keep saying one day a month, like I hate my life and I want to kill somebody at work, or I'm like, oh God, I can't do this, or, you know, my team's troubling me, or I'm having some personal problems. So it's not like I don't go through bad phases, but I've had the ability to talk about it now rather than just internalize it. And I think that helps. So that was probably my lowest mental health phase. I think the last 3-4 years, ever since I have discovered the power of sort of sharing my stories, being vulnerable and realizing that I don't need to be perfect, have been really good for happiness and confidence.
That's beautiful. Pam, but like the corporate career, how did the trailblazing start?
So the corporate career is, one, I have to tell you, the corporate career is less glamorous than it is made out to be in your... So I like tried to jump off, right, for this corporate career. And so my first job was at McKinsey, which is like a top consulting firm in the world. Now, when I joined McKinsey, I was like very excited about it. I was like, okay, I'm going to be a strategy consultant and I'm going to sit in this conference room and come up with like strategies and, you know, white smoke is going to emerge.
Just for the listeners, could you explain what a consultant does?
So a consultant is basically, consulting companies basically advise corporates, Fortune 500 companies, large companies on various paths, how to turn around their HR, how to change their operations. There's basically a problem that a company could be going through and they hire a consulting company because they have got expertise seeing many different companies. So that's what a consulting company does. And consulting is a career that people are very excited about because at a very early age, it gives you exposure to different businesses, different problems, and you think you're actually going to sit and advise them, right? So now when you think consultant, like you're a consultant to me, you think you're probably advising me on something. So my impression was, you know, I'm going to sit in a suit and big boardroom and the CEO of this company is going to walk in and I'm going to give him advice on how to run his business. That's the perception. So for my first assignment at McKinsey was for like an equivalent of Croma, you know, one of these electronic retail firms. And it was in a city called Houston in Texas where there's no vegetarian food. And my job was to go to this electronics store and start at 4 in the morning and follow people around in this store and just catalog on a pen and paper what they were doing from 4 in the morning till 10 at night. And I was like, what is this? I was like, I tried to jump off a 19th floor of a building for this. And so that's how my corporate career started. And I mean, the reason I'm saying this is because I think entry-level jobs are not what they're made out to be. And it's not just at McKinsey. McKinsey is a great employer. But you need to go through the tough grind here. Nobody is going to give you the reins of the company and say, solve my strategy and tell me. You don't know anything, right? Yeah, yeah. So that was the first thing actually I learned in my corporate career. And I always tell younger kids who join that don't expect the first 2-3 years to be glamorous. Yeah, you're going to do very, very, very basic work. I mean, you always start life at the bottom of the totem pole again. Like if there's a totem pole, you just start life again at the bottom. Like,
yeah, which is the biggest of problem even we see in hiring, even for the media industry today. We'll hire some very talented kids who will severely lack patience.
Yeah, there you go.
And, you know, they'll fight with you for larger opportunities. You're like, dude, I need to put you through a grind first to ensure that you're capable of handling those opportunities.
Even in financial services, your first few years are sitting in front of an Excel spreadsheet and cranking models. And it's good because it builds your analytical ability. It teaches you to understand detail. It teaches you to make mistakes and go wrong. No one's going to hand over your company to a 22-year-old kid on the first day. That doesn't mean you can't make it as a young person.
Yeah.
But a little bit of the grind you have to go through in life, right? Yeah.
Like a lack of patience and a lack of the ability to sacrifice things
can
like really put a, you know, stop on your career's growth.
And I also think no job is too small, right? And I struggled with this a lot. So I would sit in Texas at like 10 at night. And I would sit in the warehouse and start crying. And I would be like, what am I doing? And I wouldn't tell my parents about this because I was like embarrassed that this was my role at McKinsey. But I realized it was the right thing for them to do. And it wasn't just me. It happened to everybody, right? You just go through the grind. First year jobs are like that. And they get better and better. Mm-hmm. And by the way, even now, I mean, people wonder about a CEO's role. 30% of my profession is a lot of this grind. I mean, it's just a lot of random stuff that doesn't appear glamorous, that's not very fun, but you have to do it.
Before the CEO journey began, and I'd like to call you a multi-billion dollar CEO today. I have to sell my podcast with a little bit of masala.
Okay, so
anticipate that the thumbnail might contain a
multi-billion. Okay. Managing multi-billions. So that's accurate.
But you had an entrepreneurship journey before that. So what took you from consulting to starting your own firm and then being bought over by someone else?
So I always say that young people have a little bit of hunger and foolishness in them. I again try to rationalize why I did this. So I did the consultant gig and then I worked on Wall Street for a few years. Great years because I did 2006 and 7 and then I did 8, which is like most of what you see in the movies is true. About Wall Street of 2000.
Like Wolf of Wall Street?
Wolf is a little extreme, but things like The Big Short, etc. I mean, elements. I was actually trading mortgages. That was my first job on Wall Street. You know, so very selling loans to people who had no income, no job, and no assets. They were called ninja loans at that point in time. So,
like, okay, you don't have a house, take a loan from us. Yeah, and then pay it over the rest of your
life. Lena, tum, baad mein dekh lena. Here, take a Ranveer. You're eligible for a $2 million loan. I know you have no income, no job, no assets. Something like that. So yeah, we did that for 2-3 years.
How are Indians perceived on Wall Street?
As very smart people. I mean, Wall Street has a ton of us.
Oh, okay.
I think globally, and I have... I mean, this is an interesting conversation. So my dad's represented India from the 70s to, you know, 2020 or 2015 when he retired. I think the perception of India globally has changed completely. And he said this when he retired. He's like, so he keeps telling me, he says, you market mutual funds for a living, but I sold India for a living, which is just a beautiful thing he says. But he has seen the kind of respect that he was given in the 70s, which, I mean, your US and German counterparts, I don't think thought of him very much at that point in time. But then there was this 80s phase and it wasn't a great phase. And then 90s happened and the IT boom happened. So when I moved to Nigeria in 95, kids would ask me in school, you're from India, do you go to school on elephants? And are you from the land of snake charmers? This was the perception. By the time 95, 96, 97 happened, the whole IT boom happened, we made a statement with Pokhran, remember? And that made a lot of news. There were sanctions on us at that point in time. The, you know, the whole tests happened. And then by the time my father retired, India had gone through and become an economic superpower. So the kind of respect he got from the German ambassador or the Japanese ambassador changed totally. And that's a reflection of Wall Street too. So I think as our economic standing has changed, our perception has changed. So perception is Indians are very, very smart, capable people.
Yeah, on a very personal, selfish level,
yeah.
My goal in life is to change the perception of India as the creative capital of the world. And the... artificial intelligence capital of the world, because I do feel that in designing artificial intelligence products, there will be a huge requirement of creativity. And that's the phase of life I want to begin at 35. Like,
so creative is an interesting one because I think we're very good jugaad artists. And I don't like the word jugaad, even though it's been associated with India. But sort of original thinking and innovation and creativity, I think we can still do a lot more. So we're very good at copying.
Yeah, while, you know, we've had people on the podcast who are not very hopeful about India's future. Like people in their 40s, 50s. Yeah. But I don't know whether it's the meditation-based intuition, whether it's just my gut from running YouTube channels and talking to the youth on such a macro level. I feel like we're heading into a good phase.
So if people your generation and my generation are not optimistic, then I really worry for India.
I feel we are the two generations that are optimistic. It's the ones, you know, older than yours. You're 83 born? So I'd say the people born in the 60s and 70s, yeah. They are the pessimists.
So interestingly, I mean, this is a detour, but when I moved back, you know, it's been 10 years since I've moved back from the US. And there's this lovely Indian thing that when you move back from the US, it's a very big deal to move back from the US. Wall Street ka career, you've left to come to India. So people always ask me this question, did you regret it? Like, till date, everyone asks me this question. you know, do you miss the US? And then, of course, there's the famous one, what would your salary have been in dollars if you were living in the US? Which is a totally irrelevant question. I always say, talking about optimism, that I don't regret it at all. And the reason I don't regret it is the US is such an evolved place. It's a great market. But see, it's a market where most problems have been solved. So you really have to do things at a third order to make any impact. Here, I think with what you're doing or what I'm doing, there's so many people we can cater to, and we can do basic things and solve a lot of problems. So you can make tremendous impact here, which I don't think you can make in a market like the US.
Yeah, I completely resonate with what you're saying at the age of 27. But at age 22, it was my alpha ego kicking in, saying that, no, I want to be a king in this country and not a second-class citizen there, which may not even be true. Like, you know, I'm sure that once you're in the US...
Yeah, you settle down. It's a country that takes you in very nicely.
Yeah, they're very accepting people.
Very, very accepting.
Which I've learned over time.
Yeah,
but
very
back,
accepting.
Back then, the ego told me that, no, let's become...
Yeah, I want to be here.
Raja here.
Yeah.
But that brings me to my question on entrepreneurship. Yeah. What was that journey like starting your own business? Because I've seen that a lot of people who try transitioning from the corporate world into the business, and I'm not generalizing, but I have seen a bunch of people who can't really keep up with the world of entrepreneurship because, for example, in the world of corporates, if you eat a banana and you want to throw the peel somewhere, there's a dustbin kept in you and you can throw it. In the world of entrepreneurship, if you eat a banana, there's no dustbin to throw it into and you have to buy the dustbin yourself.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story about the dustbin. But no, it is a very... I mean, people keep saying the US to India transition. I think employment to entrepreneurship is a very big transition, especially when you're young. I will say I was a super arrogant, like, Wall Street kid.
How old were you?
24.
Okay.
So, and 24 is not young for a startup person. It's a little young for a financial services startup person because we are a gray hair and, you know, we like gray hair, right? It's a business of trust.
I'm sorry, I'm cutting you short.
Yeah.
But why? Okay, for example, I chose content entrepreneurship because I was very fascinated with the world of content.
Yeah.
You know, I loved watching television and I thought, wow, I want to get into this business. I want to show people visuals.
Yeah.
And that's why I chose content and media as my domain.
Mm.
What initially made you choose finance? Because on the outside, it can seem boring to a lot of people.
Okay, so I'm not going to give you the glamorous answer to this. See, there are people like you, and I think you're taught that, you know, you should find your passion and you should follow your passion and all that stuff. And I think that's great, right? And there are people like you who find your passion in life. I was just a good student who went to a management school, and it happened to be a finance and management-centric school. Now, Dad had never had a corporate career for me to know that I... So if you are going to ask me, did you want to do finance since you were a kid? No, I had no idea what this was, right? I think some of us just start in careers and we grow to love our careers as we... It's almost like arranged marriage, right? Some of us find our life partners and we choose them and, you know, we fall in love and then we get married. But some people, I mean, a lot of this country has arranged marriages and you marry someone and... It works.
Mm.
And I think that's my case. And now I have stayed in the profession for 15 years because one of the good things about finance is that you're constantly learning something. So one of my old bosses at AQR used to say, so I used to ask him that, listen, you have yachts, right? You have all the money in the world. Why are you doing this at the age of 50? And he's like, you know, this is the only profession in the world where you always have something new to learn every day because either you should be making money every day or you have something new to learn and nobody makes money every day. So I think it's a very dynamic industry and that's what I love about it. And that's why I've stayed around in it. But I just found it because I was a kid at a management school.
Stimulating?
Very, very stimulating. It can be as stimulating as you want it to, especially in a country like India where the market is evolving. See, you are living in a country where the prime minister is going to people and still saying open bank accounts.
And you have hyper-rich people who know what to do with their
money. Yeah, and you, so you have the whole range. And you have a capital market that is constantly evolving. So you have lots of people where you can make a tremendous impact. And it's the most heartening thing in the world to have someone say, you know, I did an SIP and I'm so happy I invested in mutual funds and I was able to pay for a surgery or do something like that or my dreams were able to come through. I mean, ultimately, we are in the business of money management and we make people's dreams come true. People invest and people save and they make dreams come true, whether they are a vacation or a business or whatever it is. So in that sense, it's a very rewarding profession.
The stimulation and the ability to help other people is the joy of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you could make a woman independent and enable her to start her own business. You know, you could change the financial fortunes of a family. So there is a deeper purpose. I think it's not Wolf of Wall Street. We're not the evil industry that the media makes us out to be.
Mm.
By the way, we're also not like the hyper... I mean, I hate the media portrayal of us. We're not like the, you know, high, glamorous, like there are girls all around and there's this high, rich life. Most financial services professionals are actually very... If you talk to fund managers who manage money, like fund manager is someone who manages your money, if you give me money, they're very quiet people and they're very burdened by the responsibility of managing someone else's money. It's actually very easy for me to manage my own money. But when you give me money to manage, I feel stressed here. There is a responsibility that there are thousands and lakhs of people who we are responsible for. So I think that's also another. So we are, there's a word in our industry called fiduciary. But fiduciary means you're responsible for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we live with that responsibility every day. I sometimes think people don't understand that.
So that's the stimulation part of it. But was it stimulating enough for you to say, okay, I want to start a business in this? Business can be a very brutal game.
So business teaches you some things. So I was an investment professional, right? But as you said, there are lots of other things that happen in running a company that you have no idea about when you have a corporate career. And I think there's so many things that you learn once you run a business. For instance, if you run a money management business, someone also has to run the office and do administration. Someone also has to do accounting. Someone also has to hire people. Someone also has to do marketing. And we are a regulated business, so someone also has to do legal and tax. Now, in the US, someone else is doing it for us. When we started, there were three of us partners. And so...
It was you, your husband?
Me, my husband, and a third partner who was a colleague of mine in the US. All three of us had only investment backgrounds. Now, somehow I became the person who decided to leave investments and do everything else. So I remember setting up our company with registrar of companies and going to the ROC website and filling the name. And I remember applying for the PAN card and fighting with the IT guys as to why our PAN card has not come and opening our first bank account with State Bank of India. So it really teaches you that, listen, you know, in corporate India, ownership can be like, oh, it's his department. I mean, it's almost like when you call someone at a call center, he's like, ma'am, this is not my problem. When you run a business, everything is your problem, right? And I was the one, in fact, I'd get into trouble for saying this. We had come from the US, so we didn't realize you have to have a sign in Hindi and Marathi on the door outside of the company. And we didn't do that. So I actually got a shop and establishment tax notice in my name. And I realized this is also the stuff that you have to manage. And I'm so grateful I did it because today... In a CEO stint, you don't only look at money management. You also manage marketing. You also manage an office. You also manage HR. In fact, you spend more time managing HR. I learned all of this in my Forefront Capital stint. So I was very well prepared.
But your basic product was that you'll take someone's money and help them take care of it.
Yeah,
you'll
so
manage it for them.
Our first product was a portfolio management service, which is basically that you'll take someone's money, rich people's money, and help them manage it. Our second product was something called an alternative investment fund, which is like... it's like a mutual fund for the rich. So it is more sophisticated in terms of what it can do than a mutual fund.
And probably you need more money to invest in this than you would need.
1 crore minimum versus 1,000 rupee minimum, which I managed today.
Mm.
So those were our first set of products.
How do you convince rich people to part with the money and give it to you?
It's hilarious. So the minimum that SEBI lets you take from a client in a portfolio management service is 25 lakhs. So that's what we started with. And we would go to friends and family and say, please give us money. And, you know, you have this belief that when you are a Wharton return graduate, people are like waiting to give you money, you know, you said Ivy League return. Nobody cares.
But does every Wharton graduate or every Ivy League graduate have that capability of actually multiplying those 25 lakhs?
Well, forget multiplying it. Can you even convince someone that you can multiply it?
But say you have good sales skills. Do you think they have they are good enough and strong enough to...
So I think money management is a very basic profession. I think, you know, it's a profession that involves understanding what is a good business and what is not a good business. And whether you're a Wharton graduate or a not Wharton graduate, I think if you're a strong thinker, if you're disciplined about your approach, and if you know what is a good business, you will be able to do it. So I don't think it's that difficult in industry. It's a difficult industry in terms of temperament. So one of the things my husband says, because he's also a money manager, is that this is a career where every week it's like a report card comes out on you. It's almost like the film industry, because you do badly for a month or 2 months and people start, you know, questioning the last 10 years of what you've done. So in that sense, temperamentally, it's a very difficult business. And markets move up and down. And you know, we live in like a social media and noise-induced world. So there's so much noise. So just to maintain a calm, disciplined temperament and have conviction that, okay, I like this company. It's going to do well. I don't care about what other people say. I think the temperamentality of money management is pretty underrated.
So most portfolio management services in India, like, because I know a lot of our listeners actually think of their life with that target of at some point, I will definitely invest with a PMS firm.
Okay.
That's just how young people think. Thanks to influencers like myself.
Ah, there you go.
Basically, a PMS firm in India, what do they do with those 25 lakhs or 30 lakhs once they have it in their hand? Is it all stock market? Is it a mixture of FD stock market?
Sure. So, I mean, look, there are multiple ways to get your money managed in India. Mutual fund is one, PMS is the other, and there's a third called AIF. PMS and AIF are meant for, so PMS requires a minimum ticket size of now, 50 lakhs is the minimum you have to put in. AIF requires 1 crore. All of them invest basis certain rules. So all of them have an objective, right? So you could have a mutual fund or PMS that is focused on the stock markets. You could have one that is partly stock markets and partly debt markets. You could have one that is just doing safe instruments. So it's very important to understand what the objective of what you're getting into is. Like you could have a health podcast, or you could have a food podcast, or you could have a music podcast.
And I just want to add one nugget here for the listeners. Like people often who are not from the financial world get intimidated by these words like PMS, mutual fund. Like they get very, that's the big hurdle I think for your industry, to tell people, listen, all this is very basic and simple. All these things are very, whatever ma'am saying, if you're not understanding it, pause this podcast or pause this YouTube video, go Google it and come back.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's a ton of financial education out there. So I always tell young people, just learn. And I mean, you know, guys like you have made expertise out of it. But the big challenge for my industry is to try and just simplify communication. You know, we've interestingly started a podcast where we're trying to explain people the basic principles of investing through Ramayan, which is a very homegrown kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or we're releasing a TV ad next week where we're trying to use Kabaddi as a medium to explain one of our financial products. So we're also trying to simplify it because I agree, we have too much jargon.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the big hurdle. Honestly, I remember being a 23, 24 year old getting concerned about managing my money.
Yeah.
And the big intimidation factor was this, that I didn't understand what my wealth managers were talking. Like, and then I had to stop them. I had to actually take out my phone, Google, or call up a friend who's in finance and say, bro, can you please explain this in like simple words? And there is always a simple way to explain it.
Absolutely.
But it's the challenge that your industry faces as a whole. It's not...
Well, one thing I would tell young people though is that, you know, even if you are a financial services professional, you will screw up in your 20s with your money management. I mean, I have made major mistakes. And out of recklessness or lack of knowledge, and it's okay. Because if you make them in your 20s, you make them when you're not very rich. I mean, you have your life to earn, right? So it's better to start, learn, invest a little bit, make mistakes. Hopefully in 5 years, you'll learn something and you'll learn what suits you personally, right? And then you'll be okay. So it's okay to make mistakes in your 20s. In fact, inevitably, you will make mistakes. You make mistakes in your career also, right? So why not in money?
And these financial mistakes are being spoken about by someone who created an extremely successful financial services business and then got bought over by Edelweiss.
So, I mean, tons of mistakes, which is okay.
So, I mean, I'm guessing that you finally got your first client. And then that led to a snowballing effect where you did a good job for that person. So then you got more clients.
So I got my first outside client. And this is a really hilarious thing. I mean, it's about social media. So the first few clients we got were all friends and family, right?
Yeah. I just, again, want to cut you short for a second. Just to explain to the listeners that I'm guessing the business model here is you manage someone's money and the profits you make on that money, you take a cut from those
profits. So... Again, that's so you manage someone's money and you charge a small fee for managing that money. So it could be like 1-2% is typically the fee. Sometimes in some products, you charge something above the profit. So like if I make 15%, then I'll take something of that. But the basic money that we make is a small, it's like a bank charge. It's called a management fee in our business. So it's a fixed fee for managing your money.
Got it.
Typically it's 1-2% of your money.
Got it.
That we charge.
Got it.
Yeah.
But then what happened once you got your...
So first few clients were all friends and family. Then I got this advice from someone very famous in financial services. I won't take his name. I was like, okay, so all the clients were getting our friends and family. Now, how do we get non-friends and family? Because you're going to run out of that bank of people, right? And you're a young kid. So he said, you know, there are all these TV channels like CNBC and ET Now, etc. He's like, India, mein, and he actually said this in Hindi. He's like, jo dikhta hai, wo bikta hai. I mean, whatever is visible actually sells. So he's like, you have to promote your brand. You have to go out and build a brand. So I remember going on LinkedIn and talking to all these journals. And I'm like, can I show up on your TV channel? And that's what I did. And I started writing articles on money control. My first external client actually was a guy who read an article of ours in Money Control. And he showed up to our office. He lived in Thane. Showed up to our office, which is a little industrial estate in Worli. And he gave us 2 crores at that point in time. When we had a total of 2 crores, he gave us another 2 crores and he didn't know us. And he just liked what we had said in the media. That's actually how we got out. And then the business grew from there. In fact, it's unfortunate, but he died 2-3 months ago in the lockdown. But he remained an investor with us for 10 years.
You'd written a thread about this on your Twitter. But yeah. Please go follow Radhika ma'am on Twitter. You are one of the reasons that I say that there's a new wave of Twitter happening in this country. So people's perception of Twitter is that it's entirely political, which is not true.
Yeah.
It's one of the easiest ways to grow your mind. It's a very underutilized tool in the
and
modern
to share
world.
Your thoughts, good or bad.
Yeah, I think you discovered us also off Twitter, I'm guessing.
I discovered most cool people I know off Twitter. Mm. I mean, Twitter has done so much for me. And I just think that people complain a lot about Twitter. But if you look at the positive side of Twitter, Twitter has... Like, we're a young brand. It's totally democratized. I mean, in the earlier days, marketing was about having big budgets, etc. Now you can have good content and Twitter gives you reach as an individual and as a brand. So I love Twitter. And, you know, if 5% of people are trolling me, hey, it's okay. It's all good.
Yeah. I think that's a modern life hack. You just need to learn how to embrace the concept of trolling early in life.
Yeah.
And you will be able to grow massive.
Don't you get trolled offline? Doesn't some relative tell you, yaar, tu bahut moti hai? Or like, I mean, don't you get trolled offline?
Yeah.
So why do you object to online trolls? And
it's a part of the new modern human experience.
Yeah. That's so it's all, I actually have fun with them sometimes. Yeah. I've chosen to not talk to them, but I have fun reading them.
Trolling in Twitter, being trolled in the corporate world by older guys.
Yeah.
So, why did Edelweiss buy you guys out? Like, what does a big company like Edelweiss perceive in a privately owned company and say that, okay, we need to buy these people? Is it that they want to buy the assets, which is people like you, that I want a Radhika Gupta to work at Edelweiss? Uh-huh. Do they see that? Do they see all the portfolios you're managing?
So, I think it's a combination. And, you know, selling your company is a super emotional thing. And we talk to a lot of buyers. We actually spent about 9-12 months in this whole acquisition process.
How long did you actually run the company before?
4.5-5 years. 2009 to 2013. So long enough. And then we started this process of kind of selling the business. And honestly, we spoke to companies bigger and smaller than Edelweiss. Now, people think these deals are done only for the money and, you know, you sell your startup for XYZ. I can promise you, and, you know, you said that you wanted to talk to Edelweiss, you know, and work for them out of college. The reason we picked Edelweiss was the brand and the culture. You have to find, financial services businesses are not food businesses where you just sell it and you walk away. They buy the business for the founders because they expect the team will hang on. Now, if you as a group of people have to work with a company afterwards, your primary criteria is, dude, is this a place I want to work?
So it's a marriage rather than a buyout.
Absolutely. And I said this again and again when I did the deal that it's a partnership. It's not an acquisition. And, you know, people always, in fact, when we sold the business, people kept saying, they're going to eat you alive. Corporate India is going to, because this was our first time working in Indian corporates. They were like, oh, it'll be a lala company. It will eat you alive. I mean, all the standard stuff. Thankfully, they have not eaten me alive. And in fact, the partnership was a 4-year partnership, after which, you know, my husband and I could have moved on. But we haven't moved on, right? We've stayed and grown. One of the things I like about Edelweiss, and this is very rare, I don't think they get enough credit, is it's one of the few financial services companies in India that really cares about young talent. Most of the CEOs are super young. I mean, there are a lot of CEOs who are in the 35, 40 age. That doesn't happen in this country. Like, we just like people with gray hair. I mean, I got this opportunity when I was 33. So you have to give something to people.
What do you think they saw in you at 33?
I think with Edelweiss, it's always been a passion to do something. They know that the advantage of young people is that they are passionate and they adapt to change. So if you are a challenger brand, you have to be someone who is open to changing, right? You have to be someone who is like, okay, I don't care what anyone else is doing. I don't care if I'm small. I'm just going to go out and make a mark. So I think that ability to adapt and change in young people is something that they like to take a bet on. And because they saw that in me, I've had the confidence to hire young people in my team. So most of my hiring has been very young.
Ma'am, like, I know, like, you're one of the most humble people I've spoken to. And I've spoken to CEOs where I don't sense humility. And I hate doing this to you. But I read a very, very interesting stat about what's happened at Edelweiss after you took over.
Yeah.
Could you just share some of those, just like that number with the viewers about those many billions of dollars that you're managing now and what you're aiming for in 2025?
Okay, yeah. So one is the aspirations are super large. So I've seen Edelweiss Mutual Fund, and we have ranks, right, in our industry of 45 mutual funds.
A hierarchy.
Yeah, it's like it's literally, it takes the money you manage, which is called assets under management. So that's the money you manage. So I may manage 100 crores, you may manage 200 crores. And
you're ranked based on that.
Yeah, you're ranked based on that. And these ranks come out every quarter. And there's like a lot of social media hoopla about these ranks. So it's a very league table obsessed industry. So I've seen us as 36th rank. We just broke into the top 15 this quarter, which we're super excited about. And I've seen us manage 6,000 crores of money, which is a little less than $1 billion. And we probably manage a little less than 50,000 crores of money in the last few years.
So from 6,000 to 50,000.
Yeah. And I mean, look, the aspiration is, and I've said this in interviews, that we want to manage 3 lakh crores. People also ask, you know, what's the strategy to get to 3 lakh crores? And I don't think I have an answer to that. I don't think you need to have answers to that. Even at 6,000 crores, I don't think I had an answer as to how we'll get to 50,000. But I did know that from 6, I'm going to grow this business to 9 and 10. And from 10, I'll grow it to 15. So life is a series of small steps taken daily. And as you take those small steps, a little bit more confidence develops in you. A little bit of luck also comes into play. A few opportunities come and you grab them. And, you know, lo and behold, you grow.
The term CEO is intimidating.
Yeah.
Especially on the outside, amateur listeners, college kids, we don't even know what a CEO does. So I have two questions. One, do all the companies have different roles for their CEOs? And two, what does your life as a CEO entail? Like, what do you do? Okay, like, what's your daily work?
Okay, so the daily work changes day on day, but I think it's unfortunate that a CEO role is intimidating. And I've had these debates with my father. I think the old model of the CEO role being intimidating in itself is a problem. I don't think the CEO is the one who sits in the corner office and like, everybody's really scared of the CEO who's going to walk in. I think a CEO is a people's leader, right?
The coach of the team.
The coach of the team, the mentor of the team, the guide of the team. And it's, you're one among equals. And I'll always say that, you know, organizations have these designations, etc. We are all playing roles. But the CEO is, I think, a few things. One, you lead a team. And I think I spend 50% of my time doing HR, by the way. I literally spend 50%. I mean, you think it is the easiest thing to do to hire a bunch of smart people and you just assume they're all going to work together. They don't. You have to facilitate it.
There's ego clashes.
You manage egos. You manage interpersonal issues. Sometimes you'll just be sitting in meetings where you have no technical contribution, right? Because I'm not a technical expert in every department, right? But I'm just there to facilitate two people working together. Or I'm there to just motivate a team and then tell them that they can do it. So I think, firstly, we are people leaders. Secondly, and I think you'll understand this well, we are also carriers of the brand. Because, you know, when you're CEO of Edelweiss Mutual Fund, your responsibility is to carry the message of Edelweiss Mutual Fund everywhere that you go and make sure that people think the highest about Edelweiss Mutual Fund. So I like wake up every day thinking like I represent the brand and I have to be the best ambassador of the brand. I mean, this is something I learned from my father. So he said, I'm ambassador of India, right? His title all these years was ambassador of India. And all his life, he spent marketing India and making sure that people thought the best about India.
Mm.
And I think of myself as an ambassador of Edelweiss Mutual Fund. So I think that's the second role that we do. And then, of course, you know, you do a lot of routine stuff and you manage business and you make sure the company is profitable and all that stuff happens. But first, you're a leader of people and you're an ambassador of the brand.
Yeah. The one common thing I've seen in all the CEOs I've met is, yeah, they have different personalities, different ways about going about things, but all of them are good communicators. Like any thoughts that they have, and it's often a massive amount of thoughts, they're able to articulate it very simply.
So I'm told this and I didn't believe this. But actually, over time, I've realized that I think it matters because, you know, it's one thing to have thoughts and in India, I don't think it's as much about thoughts. It's about convincing a large number of people that this is what, if I say tomorrow, we all have to wear red t-shirts because that's what's going to be good for the company. It's about convincing everyone that they have to wear a red t-shirt tomorrow and making sure that they wear a red t-shirt tomorrow. And that is communication.
Mm.
And I think a CEO has to be an optimist and has to be a communicator because you have to lift people up and inspire them.
What would you like to tell young girls who are watching this and telling themselves, I'll never be a CEO?
It starts with you believing that you'll be a CEO. In fact, you know, the thing that irritates me or inspires me the most when I interview fresh candidates is I ask them, look, what do you want to be in life? And then they'll say, you know, I just want to be a manager or like I want to grow in. I want to hear that you want to be a CEO. There's a beautiful little quote that I read a long time ago as a kid that if you aim for the stars, you will reach halfway through. So if you aim for less than a CEO, I don't know where you'll get. I mean, it's like, Ranveer, if you wanted to play cricket and your son or you aimed to be a cricketer, you would always say, I want to be Tendulkar. I want to play for the national team. Nobody says, I'm going to be a Ranji Trophy player or I'm going to play for my state team. So I'm saying the biggest thing to tell little girls and guys is set aspirations here.
Yeah.
Be hugely ambitious.
Yeah.
And ambitious is not a bad word. It's not a bad word for a girl.
Yeah. And I also want to highlight this other thing told to me by Manish, who's a common friend. And, and this is also something I only learned after starting my own businesses and like learning about professional life through people like yourself. It's a beautiful concept. And this is something even Mukesh Ambani has said himself. He said that it took my dad, Dhirubhai Ambani, maybe 40 years to build out his legacy. It probably took me 20 years to build out a much larger legacy. And it'll take my kids 10 years to build out a much larger legacy than what I've built in 20 years. And the reason for that is India.
Yeah.
The spectrum and the number of people that we have. This is something that young people underestimate. Like I remember being in engineering college and I always had the same question that why are these people aiming so low in life? Like, and I had that perspective, fortunately, because of having a lot of business savvy friends outside of engineering college who weren't studying engineering, who were studying BBA, who were running their own businesses in college. I used to talk much more to them. And I used to have this disconnect with my engineering college friends. And I asked my business savvy friends in engineering college, do you sense this with all these other people? Like, why are they aiming so low? And they told me that, dude, it's just cultural upbringing. They've been told that you're in engineering college, you better have a stable job at the end of it. And that's it.
It's that whole... mehnat karo, naukri mil jayegi, settle ho jao.
Yeah, and at the core of it, it's a status game. The parents want to be able to tell their friends that, oh, my kid's got a great job.
Yeah, right, wo settle ho gaya hai, fir uski shaadi bhi theek ho gayi hai, and then if you're a woman, then you have kids and all that. But why aim low? At least start by aiming really, really high. And I think this is definitely an Ivy League education. It forces you to aim really, really high. At least start thinking that you're the best in the world, right?
Yeah.
I, you know, one of the things I always used to tell my team, even when we were ranked 36, is that, you know, the league table can call your rank anything. Okay, that's reality. But in your head, you have to be number one.
And
in your head, you have to be number one because if you think like number 36 in your head, you will always stay at number 36.
100%. You know, and one thing I've learned about business and entrepreneurship and careers is that anything is possible.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
like,
my God.
You can aim for the stars. And it'll just boil down to how much you're willing to execute.
And sometimes, you know, and I've seen this in my last 3-year career, you know, things like Bharat Bond and some of the things that we've done. I mean, opportunities come at you and you think there's no chance that I'm going to have to get this. Or, you know, why would this come to me? Why would I get this? And it just happens. If you want it hard enough. I mean, look, so don't judge me for this. I'm a total Shah Rukh Khan fan of some time. And I actually really believe that whole dialogue about agar kisi cheez ko sachche dil se chaho, toh actually the world conspires you to make, you to succeed.
My reason for choosing this career and not creating, say, comedy content or light-weighted content is that I want to breed entrepreneurship in India. I want to share my mistakes. I want to share the fire. I've been blessed. I've been born with a lot of fire and I just want to put it out there for the world. And, if there's ever 100 billionaires of the world list, I want 50 to be from India. And I want 49 to be like listeners of this podcast. I know it's too high a name. But at least they should have heard one podcast and got some fire.
And I want 25 of them to be women.
I really hope so.
I want 25 of them to be women.
I want that to be a change through the podcast. And I'll tell you why. Again, there's this concept I read about a lot. So it's this concept of matriarchal societies. I believe that Bhutan is a matriarchal society.
Parts of the Northeast.
Yeah, parts of the Northeast. Kerala.
Kerala.
And you know what it does? I've been to the Northeast. I've been and spoken to men from matriarchal societies. Again, I will get hate from this because, India does have its section of people who do not believe at all in this concept.
Oh, anytime I say something pro-woman on Twitter, there's like 10% of people who are going to hate me.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's okay.
That's okay. We'll bear some of those arrows short. Why do you think a matriarchal society is good for the earth? I'll let you take that answer first and then I'll give my own perspective. Also, could you just explain what matriarchal societies are in very simple words to the listeners?
So I think matriarchy is where women play a strong role in society. I think you mentioned Kerala in the Northeast. I've also seen this, my mother-in-law hails from Mangalore. And I think the advantage of a matriarchal society, and forget matriarchal society, of lifting women, is that when you lift a woman, you lift a community. And when you lift a community, you lift an economy. Yeah.
Just want to give a nugget, like a story here.
Yeah, go ahead.
In Israel, so the country was developed after World War II, where they had Jews from all over Europe and all of the world settle into Israel.
Yeah.
But they didn't know how to unify everyone. So they did this very interesting thing where they made Hebrew compulsory and Hebrew was like their Sanskrit. Like how Sanskrit is kind of...
It was their unifying thing.
Yeah. Sanskrit is kind of... Yeah. It's dying out in India. It's totally coming back slowly.
Yeah.
It's coming back gradually. Uh-huh. Like people are getting interested in Sanskrit again. But Hebrew was a language that had entirely died out. And the government didn't know how to bring back Hebrew completely.
Yeah.
So they made Hebrew compulsory for everyone till 4th standard.
Mm-hmm.
But for all the girls till 10th standard.
Yeah.
Because the girls would become mothers and they would teach the entire families. That's the core concept of matriarchy, that women have this ability to unify, to what we call galvanize. So galvanizing in engineering is when you dip another metal in zinc and the whole metal gets covered in zinc.
Yeah.
That's the power of a matriarchal society. When people learn to look at societies, businesses, life like that and not just, I don't want women to get power, I want men to be in power. That's when we'll really start.
So we had, my mother-in-law had this maid, and I think I've told this story before, from Mangalore. And she, I think, maybe would have been 4th or 5th pass. And she came to Bombay and she started working with my mother-in-law. Now, she didn't know any English, I think Kannada medium or whatever, and then was forced to drop out of school to support a big family of brothers, etc. So she brought up my husband. And then I think when my husband's aunt went abroad, she went abroad with her. And she traveled the world, she learned English, she did everything. Came back to Bombay and she was able to migrate 2 or 3 of her sisters from the village into Bombay. She was able to settle down her family and buy them land in Mangalore. And she became a base for other girls of that community in Mangalore to come settle down in Bombay. So that is the galvanizing effect that a woman can have. She now, by the way, she paid for her own wedding. She's now sending her 2 daughters to English medium schools. And I think that shift now from Hindi, Kannada medium, fourth standard dropout, to sending your daughters and getting them educated. I mean, that is an orbital shift in our society, right?
Ma'am, like, what do you think are the strengths and weaknesses of both men and women? Like, could you list out strengths and weaknesses of women and also strengths and weaknesses of men?
So I won't say men and women. I'll say masculine and feminine, because I do believe that there are feminine qualities that also exist in men. But I do believe the world, actually, if you look at the skill set of the future, it favors the feminine skill set. So the old skill set, which was the masculine skill set, is analytical. I mean, like, you know, you remember these books that used to say, if two men can do a task in this much time, then how many, you know, like, can screw a light bulb, then how many men will it take to do four light bulbs, etc. So it was all commoditized tasks. I mean, nobody wrote those things about women, by the way, mm-hmm. because they know each woman is different.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the skill sets of women, they are creativity, customer experience. For instance,
that at its core, it's compassion, like understanding another human.
It's understanding. So your mother is the best provider of compassion and customer experience in the country. Your Indian mother, on average, knows how to manage her husband. She knows, like, my mother managed my father's profession and career, and she cooked samosas for everybody on 26 January because that was part of his profession. She knew how to bring me up and send me to an Ivy League school. She dealt with my brother. She dealt with her in-laws, and she ran a job of her own. She had 4 or 5 different customers in her life who she was managing to perfection every single day.
Hmm.
What is this customization of experience?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the goal of spirituality from a career and practical perspective is to balance your internal masculine and feminine energy, which in the real world means balancing your masculine and feminine skill sets. For example, if you think too much like a guy, which was me in my early 20s, it was about, I'll list out some masculine and feminine strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
So masculine strengths, I feel that guys, for some reason, and I might be wrong, please correct me if I'm wrong, but in my experience, I've seen that guys are scalable team players.
Mm.
As in, you can make a guy work with 10 other guys who are kind of in sync with him, and the team will work very well. And that 10 can even be transformed into 100.
Mm.
If those 100 guys think similarly, those 100 guys will work in unison.
If they think similarly.
Women's strengths, on the other hand, again, it's multitasking.
Yeah.
It's endurance, being able to take, like, you know, a huge amount of work.
Being able to handle pain. I mean, you know, one of the most beautiful memories of this whole COVID period is, what are the countries who've handled COVID well? Well, they seem to have women prime ministers or presidents.
To understand what's happening on the ground.
And to handle a situation of human suffering.
Mm. They say that if there are only women leaders all over the world, there won't be any wars.
So, I mean, you look at, and again, you know, you look at someone like Jacinda Ardern, right? She's a mother. And during the COVID period, she's sitting and managing her kid at home on a sweatshirt and talking to her people on video.
Mm.
And she's just making it like she's part of the problem. Yeah. She's not above everyone else because she's this untouchable. So vulnerability, which we talk about.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, I'll also bring in a bitter truth here.
Yeah.
At the cost of being pessimistic, okay? Okay. Now, a big weakness that women have, especially in Indian society, is a lot of conditioning that they've gone through.
Yeah.
Because Indian society, from the time you're a little girl, you're told certain things. Or even in the matriarchal parts of India.
And that's what I'm saying. Women need to have, because you're not told to be ambitious. You're not told to have big aspirations. And unfortunately, and I think Sheryl Sandberg said this in the American context, I think it's even more true in the Indian context, you are told to quit your job well before and make a huge deal out of this whole marriage and kids thing.
Mm.
So I have women still coming to me saying, you know, I don't want to take on a bigger project. Or, you know, I can't change jobs because I'm planning to get married. I mean,
yeah, it is how it is. And this is the bitter truth. I feel like we are one generation away from the equality you spoke of. When we spoke with us 25.
Yeah.
According to me, practically what's going to happen, and this is not something I wish.
Mm.
Like, I wish that it's 50-50.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be something like a best case scenario would be 60-40.
I hope my daughter's generation. I mean, I know that it's, I know my generation will always hear things like the only woman CEO and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I hope my daughter's generation is able to change that.
I'm
seeing some signs of it.
Because you know what's happening now is that while there is a strong feminist movement, there are two sections of that feminist movement as well. And the majority in that is just a lot of, highlighting the negatives without thinking of solutions. But the next generation will start thinking of the solutions.
And by the way, I should also tell you, so people keep asking me these questions of like, what are your challenges as a woman and all that stuff. There are huge advantages to being a woman. For instance, when you're the only woman of 44 men, and my peers often tell me I get a ton of attention, maybe much more than I should. I've had the opportunity, because I'm one of the few young women CEOs, to interview people like Arundhati Bhattacharya, to spend time with people like Zia Modi, to talk to Mary Kom. I have been given opportunities because your gender makes you different. It makes your thinking different. It makes your approach different. And the world is looking for different people. Mm-hmm. So I will not step back and say it has only been a burden. I think it is about how you look at yourself. I think people are a mirror, right? If I think being a woman is an advantage, the world will make it an advantage.
Mm. Ma'am, like when I meet other YouTubers, I know that they've been through a similar struggle. Like myself, as in it's very similar. Our journeys, our initial struggles, we had to figure out camera work ourselves, we had to figure out team ourselves, then we had to figure scaling up. So when you meet ambitious, successful women like yourself, what's that underlying vibe like? Where do you connect as sisters?
We connect on so many levels. Even when I meet women CEOs, by the way, and there's so few of us, and I have friends who are women CEOs in manufacturing businesses and who are film producers. My God, the bond is incredible, because we connect on shared experiences, and we all have shared stories. We all have shared stories of going into rooms where we're the only girl, and maybe the guy's bathroom is working, but the lady's bathroom is not working in the office. We have stories as banal as that. We have stories of being scared to talk in a conference room, because like I struggle with this even now. Like there are 15 guys talking and there's like an Arnab Goswami kind of like everyone talking over each other. I get very withdrawn. And many of my girlfriends tell me these stories. We have stories about how a lot of the socializing is done over dinners, especially in financial services in the US, over drinks and dinner. And you just don't feel comfortable talking about that. And unfortunately, and I'll get into trouble for saying this, Me Too has not helped our cause as women either in some ways. While it's made the workplace a lot safer, people are getting more scared to hire women. So we have those stories also. So women bond on many different levels. And I think probably the best part of my job is the sessions I do with young girls.
What would you like men to know about an ambitious woman's mindset?
It's not very different from theirs, and it has no reason to be different. But the only thing I would say to guys is, and I'll give you a funny example, that women are going to behave differently from you. So I get this thing with, you know, guys get very scared when women cry in the office, right? Like guy managers, they get very scared when women cry in the office. And you almost see them hyperventilate, or then they start judging. Then, oh, she's not emotionally mature and stuff like that. So I keep trying to tell guys, and I told one of my former bosses this, that is it okay for a guy to use bad language in the office once in a while? Like, we forgive it, right? We say it was a moment of anger. If a woman can express her emotions through crying, and it's not like she's crying on the floor every day, but once in a year if she's cried, don't judge it. So we're as ambitious as you, but we express ourselves differently. So just don't judge us for it.
Are you, so from your outlook, from where you stand, are you hopeful about where India is going with respect to this gender equality thing, professional gender equality mainly?
I think it can't get much worse. I only think it'll get better. I also think young girls are a lot more aspirational now. And I think even from tier 2 and tier 3 cities. So if I look at my father's family and some of the girls from Saharanpur, you know, where our family hails from, they all want professional education. I'll tell you another really interesting thing. There's this whole myth that men have in the office that the minute a girl gets pregnant, she's not going to come back. Okay? I have had countless number of girls, because we have a lot of women in the 30s bracket. All of them have their kids and they come back to work. So they know their careers are important to them. And in my mother's generation, I don't think that was the case.
Yeah, 100%. It's gradually shifting.
With her.
Now, I'm criticized by this. I mean, okay, now I'm criticized for this by my co-founder and also by like my team occasionally, that I bring in too much emotion into my work. But that's because I'm a creative professional and creativity comes out of the same place of emotion. So as my career has gone forward, I'm even more emotional. Balanced, but emotional. And that's why I'm going to use this opportunity to just request people that if there's any girl who's watching this podcast and who's looking for an opportunity, I have this goal of khada karoing, like as in establishing 1,000 entrepreneurs. So if you're watching this and you want to get into entrepreneurship, but you're scared and you don't know where to start, write into us, careers@beerbiceps.com. I hope to be a part of that change. For the sake of my sisters, for the sake of my mom, they've told me all my life about this.
And one day daughters.
I'm sorry?
And one day daughters.
Definitely. Like, I mean, I'm not a father yet. So,
yeah, but one day.
The next generation, definitely. I hope to be a part of that change, you know. And while I also have been in rooms with just guys.
Yeah.
So I know what that side of the game is also. I know how guys look at women also. And there is sexism. And there is bitching about women that happens. The whole gender.
But you know one thing? So it's really interesting. My husband joined, I'm part of a sort of CEO forum with mostly guys. And my husband also joined a forum which is for spouses, okay? And he's the only guy in this group that he's in, which is all women. And he says it totally changed his perspective because he says there is reverse sexism also. It's not about men. It's we villainize men. It's the majority that vilifies the minority. And it is very subconscious. So, you know, it's not just about men. If you were 50 people from one state and there was one more person from somewhere else, they'll all speak in their language. Yeah.
Mm.
So it is also a majority syndrome. It's not a men versus women syndrome.
Got it. Beautiful.
My husband has just seen this and he said, every guy should be in a group with a majority of women to understand what it feels like.
Yeah, I think he tweeted about this.
And he said he totally says you should do it. I've seen it change the kind of man he is.
Mm. I just hope that these series of... You're actually the first podcast in the series of women entrepreneurs podcast that we're starting.
Okay, so there'll be lots of them.
So and honestly, as a guy, only conversations like this give you the correct kind of perspective.
Yeah.
This is not conversations I have on a daily basis. But thank you, ma'am. This was a lot of fun. I'm hoping to do a lot more podcasts with you going forward.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun. I think we talked about everything under the sun.
Yeah, and I am dead sure you will reach that 3 lakh crore mark and beyond.
Thank you.
And not that you need a podcaster to
tell you. I hope I'll also influence 3 lakh people positively.
Yeah, that's the hope that this podcast goes out to a lot of people. So if you've watched it till this point, please share it with everyone you know. Men, women, everyone you know.
Young, old.
Yes, we need content like this to really go to the right people, the leaders of this country. So again, Radhika Gupta, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful.